Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for July 31st, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Join me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, well tonight, a big show. In about 10 minutes, we have Jeff Singer of Daily Coast coming on to join us to discuss the happenings of the week and looking forward to the fall election. We had the Democratic Convention, and as we were talking a little bit on the pre-show, Donald Trump just wanted to make news the whole week, too. He didn't take the week off. He just kept trying to make news, and so we'll just sprinkle a lot of that in between just talking about the Democratic Convention. But, Catherine, what were some of your just initial thoughts? Like, which one were some of the best speeches? What moments did you like the best? Maybe some things that you want to be critical of, just your general thoughts.
Well, I think, like everyone, it was really exciting to see the First Lady and all the luminaries. I thought that was, you know, it's always look forward to the poise and grace of Michelle Obama and the inspiration of President Obama and Bill Clinton and the sort of, you know, uncle Joe Biden, you know. But I have to say that I was really impressed with, and I always am, it's not anything new, but I thought Jennifer Granholm did a great job of connecting with the audience. It was a big audience, and the people that I have spoken to that were at the convention felt the same way, that she really engaged and connected with people in a way that some of the other speakers didn't. So I thought that was really good. The negative thing I thought the whole thing was really well delivered. I thought the timing was perfect. The visuals were great. The production values, everything was really good. The only thing that the only message that I thought was a little clunky was when Tim Kaine, who I actually did think came across better than I expected, and not, no offense to him, I just thought he was kind of, you know, folksy, and that was good. But I didn't like it when he went a little negative and sort of imitated Donald Trump. I thought she maybe needed to be reminded that when they go low, we go high, the message from Michelle Obama. So that was really the only thing that I thought was, the Bernie people were annoying, but as far as the people giving speeches, that was the only thing that made me pause. It wasn't really negative. It made me pause.
Yeah. Well, I'll kind of jump in with a comment or two, and then I'll pass it to Tim. I kind of thought Tim Kaine was, if you rank the speeches and the coverage they got and the buzz around them, you know, he's lucky to make the top 10, because not only did he have to compete with Hillary Clinton and President Obama and Michelle Obama, he had to compete with Kazir Khan and people that
yeah.
we didn't probably even expect before, didn't even know of before the convention. And as far as the Bernie folks, they really seemed to not be a factor after Monday. I don't know if it was Sarah Silverman shutting them up or the First Lady was so good or the tactics got better and the media got kind of tired of covering them. I'm not sure.
Well, they were
on
definitely
the floor to know, but they were not a factor on the TV the same way Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
They were definitely a factor behind the scenes, though. A number of my friends who were there were like, you know, they wouldn't stop shouting, they wouldn't stop sort of causing a ruckus, and all the way really through Thursday. So that,
yeah,
but
so
I'm glad that,
that
you know we didn't see it, so that's good.
Yeah. And that's what matters is the own TV, because if you're there as a Hillary Clinton delegate, they're not going to turn you off. And if you were carrying on doing that stuff, you're going to keep on doing that stuff. So it's really about the people on TV, the TV show that was being produced was produced well, and kudos to the campaign team for not letting that push through. Tim, what were some of your thoughts?
Well, of course, I was just delighted with Michelle Obama's speech. That was one speaker that even Trump wouldn't tweet about. Her speech was, what's the word, soaring? I guess that's the best way to put it. It was just terrific talk. Cory Booker was another one.
Oh, yeah, Cory Booker was great.
When he quoted Maya Angelou, you know, you may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust I'll rise. I hope I remembered all of that because I was trying to do that particular passage from memory. Joe Biden, old school as it gets, working man, Democrat as it gets, the guy, any man making a great talk. The president, of course, was just terrific. It was great to see all of our A-listers. Now, that was something the Republicans, of course, could not have. So our lineup was just magnificent. And at the end, Secretary Clinton's speech was very workmanlike, very effective. And I think, personally, about as good a speech as she can give. And I was pretty happy with it. I think what they needed to do got done. And of course, Mr. Khan, that was very heart rending. That one had to leave a lot of tears and a lot of eyes there at the hall, I'm sure. So I didn't see many downsides to this convention earlier than the rough patches that occurred on the first day, but by the second day, those were gone. So it was a very well done convention. It was almost like an Oscars ceremony, wasn't it, Catherine? It was choreographed.
I thought the timing of the performances by musicians and comedians and stuff was really well done. Like it flowed really well, and kept your attention.
Yeah, we didn't have Scott Baio, but we had to make do with what we had, right?
Right.
Yeah, and back to Kaiser Khan, because this seems to be, and that was it's due to Donald Trump, one of the biggest stories going out of the convention. It would have been a story the next day, but Donald Trump just really inflicted some extra wounds. One thing I was glad is I didn't actually see it live. I heard about it, and I looked it up on YouTube the next day, and I thought it was like a 5-minute version of 7 and 9. I went ahead and watched the 9-minute version, so I got the intro video where it showed Hillary Clinton speaking about him, the son, several months ago, and then it showed pictures of the son, and you really it was a better lead into the story than just hearing the speech, and the speech was just incredible with the best use of a visual aid the entire of either convention, really, pulling out the Constitution. And
that was great.
His speech was so good. But then Donald Trump, criticized, the husband by attacking the wife, and now the wife has said, look, he offered to let me speak. I just let him speak. He's the lawyer. They felt it would hurt the message to have both of them speaking. But then she gave Donald Trump a piece of her mind today, and that just made that story so much worse. And one more thing about this before we move to our guest is I noticed that Red State and a lot of other Republicans and conservatives have picked up. Mitch McConnell today praised Kaiser Khan and the family and the service and the son and everything else. The Republicans are running a mile away from Donald Trump on this one. They're really ashamed of how he's handled this. And Donald Trump's, created the problem for himself on this one completely. And there's more he's created, but we'll get into that. But now I want to welcome in our guest for the umpteenth time from Daily Kos, Mr. Jeff Singer. Welcome, Jeff.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Yes. Well, Jeff, first thing, I didn't ask you in the invitation and the notes, were you in Philadelphia?
I was not.
Yeah, and neither were we. I mean, you know, I've been to convention four, I think all of us have, but can't go to them all, but we get to see the TV show, we get to read all the other things. I guess let's just kind of take it day by day. First off, Monday, that was the day that the Bernie supporters, the ones that really are not, you know, moving to be on board, made their biggest impression, if you will. But then they kind of, it just changed after really either Sarah Silverman or Michelle Obama's speech. Did you kind of notice that they seemed to have a less of a visual impact on TV after Monday?
I did. Part of that may be some of what was happening earlier was it was just the shock value of it. So it was more apparent at the beginning. And part of it may have been some of the early reports we were getting that about the booing was during the early speeches when the convention hall wasn't that filled. So we did have more Bernie or bust delegates disproportionately there. But I think some of them did come down and did kind of at least lose energy, especially after Bernie endorsed Hillary so well in his speech on Monday. And I think Michelle Obama's speech may have also helped a bit there. And I mean, she was someone that they were not going to boo, and that they, I think, overwhelmingly do respect, even if they don't respect Hillary.
Yeah, and I just don't know. I just have the feeling that when Sarah Silverman said, "You're being ridiculous," maybe they kind of held a mirror up to themselves and kind of saw that they were being ridiculous. Because, you know, I thought to myself, if somebody gave me a ticket, you know, or dropped me into a Donald Trump speech tomorrow, I would let him speak just because that's the polite thing to do. Even if we don't agree with people, you have to have some decorum in a democracy. And I think that's one lesson that a lot of folks need to learn. There is a time to protest, but it's not, you know, when people are just making, you know, regular speeches, maybe on their way into the place or something like that. I don't know. I just kind of got that impression. Well, I'm going to pass it to Tim and Catherine for some questions, and I know I'm going to have more. So, Tim, take it away.
Well, good evening, Jeff. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing well. Listen, I'm going to jump right into this general election map right now. You got Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio. Does Donald Trump have to win all three and hold the state of North Carolina in order to barely put together enough electoral votes to win the thing?
I don't think he has a great path in all those three states, but I think it's his best one. I don't want to say that he can't win without all three, but it's hard enough to win all three. It's really, really hard to win without three of those if you're Donald Trump. I mean, right now Colorado's looking really good for Hillary. Virginia, maybe it was the Tim Kaine being put on the ticket, but there's more talk of that one being out of reach. And besides Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, Iowa, I mean, there aren't too many places Obama won that are really that soft. I mean, you know, if Trump somehow finds a way to put Wisconsin or Michigan to play, then that's a different story. But I feel pretty good about those states. So, yeah, it's pretty hard to see him winning without all three of those. And Nevada's also a potential difference maker, but that one's – the polls do show him with a good path to victory, a lot of them, but it's a state with a really high Hispanic population. The Democratic Party is very, very organized there, and polling in the past has under a city Democrats. So I don't see Nevada going for Trump in anything but a blowout for him, so – I do think it's probably his only real route to victory is Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida.
We have a longer election season this year, about a month, I guess, longer than the general election season in 2012. Who coming out of the convention? So who do you think that would favor and why?
I'm sorry. Who's the favorite after the conventions? Or
we have a longer election, general election season this year coming out of the conventions because they were so early, like a month longer than we had in 2012 when the conventions were a little later in the year. Who do you think that favors, having that extra time, and why?
That's a good question. I'm not sure it necessarily favors anyone. If it does favor someone, I think it's Hillary, because I think this convention, it did it from the early polls we're seeing, it did help her favorable ratings a bit. She's maybe not super popular, but at least she got some people who didn't like her to take another look at her. And I think if you have a higher proportion of people who do like her and are open to voting for her right now, anything she does in that extra month will be better. She'll have more people who are interested in hearing what she has to say. But we'll just have to see if this holds up. I mean, the data we have is still limited, so we don't know how much good the Democratic Convention did or how much it did of what it did was long-term. But I do think if the convention did give Hillary the chance to maybe get more people listening to her because they're taking another look, I think that extra month and the extra ads she can run because of her big financial and organizational advantage over Donald Trump, I think that's going to help.
Oh, yeah, really. I'm going to ask you one more, and then I'll throw it around to Catherine. You wrote a piece on Coast Elections about this new Suffolk poll up in Pennsylvania. It doesn't look right to me. I don't know if they sampled too many Democrats or what they did, but it doesn't fit with other recent polling in that state. We have 2 and 3 point polls, and all of a sudden here we come with a 9 point poll. What's your take on that particular poll?
So that Pennsylvania poll, it showed Hillary by leaning Trump by about 9 points. It showed Democratic Senate candidate Katie McGinty leading Republican Senator Pat Toomey by 7.
Right.
I want it to be true.
we all do.
but like you were saying, it doesn't really fit into the other numbers we've seen. For the presidential race, Pennsylvania, some polls have shown Hillary doing really well. A few have shown things much closer, or Trump winning by a little bit. A 9 point lead for Hillary, maybe. I mean, Obama did win it by about that in 2008. It's possible, but I want to see more polls confirming that before I say that's what's going on. The Senate race, though, we've seen until now exactly one poll that showed McGinty winning, and nothing in the neighborhood of 7 points.
Right.
You know, it's possible, but like we always say, when you get an unexpected poll, the best thing to do is wait for more numbers. I mean, if McGinty or Hillary are doing that well, other polls should show that, and if they're not, well, this is one poll. You know, sometimes Suffolk, they're an okay pollster. Their head a few years ago infamously went on Fox News and said about the 2012 election, you'd have Virginia, Florida, North Carolina, paint them red for Romney, and, well, Obama won two of those states, so they... Yeah, so their numbers in general, besides that little misfire, they seem to be okay, but even good pollsters can make mistakes without doing anything necessarily wrong. Sometimes you just get a bad sample, so I say we just wait for more. But until we get more, I don't want to trust those numbers on their face.
All right, then. Let's go to Catherine. Catherine?
Thanks so much for being on with us tonight, David. I think we're all, you know, experience a big lift from the convention. You know, we talked about it earlier in the show, how it seemed to be almost perfect. But I want to talk a little bit about polls. We talked about them in the pre-show, and I think I'm just wondering how reliable they can be. I think that we're all concerned about, you know, cell phones and these automated polls and the lower results that they're getting, and so the lower sample numbers and all these, how reliable and how much can we count on them in this cycle and going forward? Are they going to become less have less impact as we go forward because of all these different criteria?
That's a really good question, and that's something I think about a lot. And, well, we're not going to know how accurate they are until the election, unfortunately. But, yeah, it's no secret that U.S. pollsters have had some problems in recent years. In 2012, they underestimated Obama by a bit. In 2014, they underestimated Republicans by a bit. But in general, for most of these races, they were mostly on track. They got things about – there weren't any real – there besides the Virginia Senate race in 2014, there weren't really any – wait, what just happened moments when the polls just completely disagree with reality? So everyone should always be skeptical of polls, just the individual polls, the polls in general. Nobody should ever just take them as the truth because pollsters can make mistakes. Things do change. Methods change. Response rates, cell phones, like what you were saying. But – they are our best guide to go on, and we should always be skeptical of and not take everything as the truth, but it is a piece of evidence, and we should weigh it against what else we see.
Right. Well, and that's my point, I guess, is I think that sometimes, and I think it's gotten less this way, but I know in the past, bad polling will come out for a candidate in a state, like especially it seems like in congressional races, and then the party will abandon it, and you know we move on, and I just worry that we do that instead of just saying, okay, well let's just keep working the state, keep working the GOTV and the voter registration, just keep it going, and use the polls as a guide and as to inform us, but not dictate our activities, I guess. That's the thing that sometimes concerns me, that we put a lot of emphasis on them and it sometimes at our doom, you know, like we give up on things too soon, maybe. I'm not as much of a poll watcher in the polls, I mean, as some are. So what do you, I guess that's what you're saying, is it's just one piece.
It's one piece, and campaign organizations do have their own pollsters who do have – one problem with media polls, I guess, is the media polls don't have that much incentive to actually get it right. You'd think they would, but CNN, they want to write about interesting results. So if Trump suddenly gains 10 points, they're not going to really question it. They're just going to say, hey, this is really interesting. Let's write about it. And – that's allowed a lot of bad, really bad polls to flourish. There are a lot of bad pollsters who show such unpredictable results, but they stay in business because so many media organizations will just write up their numbers no matter how unreasonable they look. The campaigns, no campaign will have a completely will be completely impervious or to any changes in polls, but I do think their polls, because their pollsters have so much more of an incentive to actually get it right and not screw up, their numbers are going to be better, and we might not see them, but the numbers that will be guiding campaigns and party committees' actions, I think, will at least be better.
That's a good point. I wanted to also just comment on Tim asked you about the longer election season and who might benefit. I tend to agree with you that if it favors anyone, it favors Hillary, and partly because I think it gives Donald Trump more opportunities to, you know, stick his foot down his throat. Like this week, he's just been, you know, I had lunch with someone today. I said, he's just doubling down. And she was like, oh, man, he's tripling down. He's just like. And so I do think that the more time we have to make our argument, and for Hillary Clinton and all the other candidates and her surrogates and everybody else, to make our case, I think we have more time, because I think it just, you know, irritates Donald Trump, and he cannot resist reacting like he did to the Khan speech. And so I just wanted to
A very good point. That definitely seems to be happening.
Yeah, he just can't resist the tweet. Can't resist it. So I'm going to pass this to David now.
Yeah, well, Jeff, let's go back into the convention a minute, and then we're going to get back into some of the stuff Donald Trump's done in the past week. And, you know, Tim Kaine, this was our first chance to really see him. How do you think his first, I guess, first two impressions, because he did have the 60-minute interview, and then his speech on Wednesday night. What do you think his role is going to be? How much of a factor do you think he'll be in the race? Just comment on Tim Kaine.
So that's something I've been thinking of. In general, vice presidential candidates don't make that much of a difference, or they make a big difference. It's usually bad. Most people, they'll vote. If they dislike the vice presidential candidate enough, they'll vote against the ticket, but it rarely will make people say, well, I don't like Hillary, but I like Tim Kaine. But I think he'll make enough of it. He'll make a little bit of a difference in Virginia, and that could make all the difference in the world. Tim Kaine, I think she'll send him to do some outreach to more blue-collar white voters and maybe to Hispanics, since he can speak fluent Spanish. And he does have this – he's kind of fostered this image as this nice, little bit dopey Midwestern dad. That's become a Twitter meme, and some of the tweets are pretty funny, and he's kind of embraced that. And so he seems like an affable, nice guy. And I don't think he'll necessarily sell that many voters for Hillary, who wouldn't go for her anyway. But can't hurt. And if he can do any little bit of good in Virginia, that's good enough for me.
Yeah, I know that he speaks Spanish, and they say, well, that could outreach to Hispanics. But I think that may ring a little hollow because he is, you know, very white, not even just Caucasian. He's just very white, as Larry Wilmore pointed out. But I do think one thing that he is very authentic, but there's just not enough time to penetrate, is that he's a lot of his convictions come because of religion. And I think if you were to put him in front of some evangelicals that were open to listening, he might could change some of those voters over. I don't think he can do that in 4 months, but in 4 years and 4 months, maybe he could have an impact. So I don't know if that's some kind of long-term project. Do you think there's a chance that you could see maybe some evangelical whites that are particularly turned off by Trump and some aspects of the Republican platform, a person like Kaine, much like Jimmy Carter was back in 76 and 80, kind of turning some of those voters?
I mean, it's worth a shot, definitely. But he's still the vice presidential candidate, so there's only so much he can do that Hillary couldn't. And it's going to be really tough to sell people who are open to Trump and hate Hillary. And Tim Kaine can only do so much with that. But it's worth a shot. I think we can try, and, you know, if we can make a little bit of difference around the margins, it can make a big difference.
They should park him in Utah.
I mean, that is a place where it would be. I mean, those people do not like Donald Trump's stand on the border and immigration issues, for sure. Yeah, well, let me ask you a totally different kind of question. I'm going to pass it to Tim, and I know we're bouncing all over. But for the whole Republican primary campaign, we never really heard, barely saw Melania Trump. And then we've had three stories come out in the past, say, 9 days. She forged part of her speech. Either she or someone in the campaign has lied about her educational credentials, and now the New York Post has obtained pictures. Now, obviously, that shouldn't disqualify or qualify Donald Trump, you know, by itself, but it's just more bad news. What do you think the impact of Melania Trump's going to be on the election?
That's a good question. I don't think it will be that much of an impact. Just because her husband just seems to be doing anything she can do, he can do so much worse. Her plagiarizing Michelle Obama, that was a big story, but I don't know if it really cost Trump that many votes. And beyond that, anything else she does, Trump's already done it, and besides the news photos, we hope. But
I don't want to see those.
That.
Those are definitely worse.
Yeah, but he's done so many worse things. I don't think there are going to be too many people who say, well, what Trump did is bad, but I'm still with him. Oh, well, Melania's the straw that broke the camel's back. I just don't see him making that big of a difference.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pass it to Tim for some more questions. He'll go to Catherine, come back to me, and here we go, Tim.
Okay, Jeff, let me really get off the wall a little bit here. The other day, David and I were chatting, and we were talking about the schedule for all the surrogates and everything, and we noticed that the big dog, Bill, is going to be in Utah on the 11th of August. Now, the first thing we thought, well, maybe they're going to make a pass at Utah, but it suddenly hit me. Mia Love is in some trouble out there in her district. Is she not?
She is.
The latest polls has Doug Owens up by 6 points on her. What is going on with her? What is happening to her?
So Mia Love, she's been a really highly touted Republican candidate for a while, and 2012 she unexpectedly lost to the Democratic incumbent Tim Matheson, and two years later she runs, he's retired, and she wins, but only by about six points during the Republican wave. And the guy who came fairly close to beating her, Doug Owens, is running again, and it's kind of hard to say what's going wrong because this is a Republican district. Even when Romney isn't on the ballot, it does like Democrats like Matheson, and Owens does come from a prominent Utah Democratic family, so that does help. Mia Love does, she's made a lot of weird mistakes. There was this whole big thing about her making the government pay for her travels and her not explaining it very well, but there just seems to be something that people don't like. And she is black. There is the uncomfortable possibility that her race is causing her problems here. And there's really no way to know for sure what's going on there. And that's something we can't really ignore. But part of it does seem to be, she just really doesn't seem to be a very good campaigner. She does use some pretty weird methods to fundraise for her campaign, where she uses direct mail, which generates all this money but costs so much to implement, candidates don't net very much of it. All sorts of fringe candidates use that all the time, make themselves look better than they are, maybe because they don't really know what's going on. But she still does this, even in Congress. So that's just one big warning flag that she doesn't really know entirely what she's doing for a campaign. But it's been a hard one to get a hold of, and I really hope that it isn't because she's black, but that's something we really can't rule out.
Well, now, another thing that David and I were talking about, as a matter of fact, right before the show we were talking about it, this thing with the Supreme Court, its vacancy and future vacancies, it would seem that would be a really big issue. It's especially one that the Republicans love to tout. And yet, this particular issue just doesn't seem to be resonating with voters this year. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I do think it is resonating with at least some Republican voters who maybe in a different year might ditch Trump, but they do say, well, we hate him, but he'll appoint someone we like to the Supreme Court, so we'll stick with him. But in general, the Supreme Court, it's just not something very many Americans really know that much about or really understand that well. I mean, people have varied on whether it's a liberal court or conservative court, not based on what the court's really doing, but who is president. They just assumed when Obama became president, the court would become a little more liberal. That's what all polls showed. Or conservatives, voters immediately turning on John Roberts for Obamacare when, in general, he's ruled pretty well for them. So it just seems to be kind of an abstract issue. People care about the court when something really, really big is happening, but in general, then it just becomes something that just kind of gets brushed aside and forgotten about. I think more people should care about the court, but it's just kind of hard to make a big election issue off something that's kind of abstract.
Okay, well, now let's jump to another thing you wrote about a few days ago, and it's a Senate race that caught my eye. You mentioned
that the big money boys, even the Koch brothers, are, shall we say, passing on the Wisconsin Senate race. Are we seeing a strong signal that Senator Johnson is probably beaten and they're just throwing that race away, or what's going on there?
I think we are seeing that signal. Wisconsin is usually a Democratic state, and Ron Johnson has pretty much acted like he's a senator from Oklahoma, not Wisconsin. And that's happening. And Russ Feingold, he did lose 6 years ago, but he seems to have, that seems to be more the product of that year's Republican wave than anything else, and he seems to be still well regarded. So between Democratic state, really conservative incumbents, and popular Democratic challenger, you have Johnson in a really bad situation. So I think Republican groups are seeing that. But another part of it is Ron Johnson is rich, and he's not using his money to self-fund his campaign this time. He did in 2010. He's not this time. And I think a lot of Republican groups are really annoyed about that and say, look, this is a really tough race, and if you're not willing to put your money where your mouth is, we have other things to do.
Okay, well, and are you prepared to say then, Jeff, that Johnson is highly likely the top Republican incumbent senator that is going to lose on Election Day?
I think along with Mark Kirk in Illinois, they're the most likely to lose. I think the odds are pretty good they're going to lose. I don't want to say it's in the bag yet, but he's in a really bad – they're both in pretty really bad situations. So if they're not losing, it either means something I think has gone really, really wrong in one of their races, like one of their opponents, something really bad happened to them, or Trump is winning already really well. So – I think that they're going to lose. I feel pretty confident.
All right. Well, with that, I will throw it right back to Catherine. Catherine?
Thanks. Well, that's great news. I can't wait to have Russ Feingold back in the Senate.
Yeah, really.
So, Jeff, what do you think? What do you think is really interesting? What you know, elections or issues or what's coming out of the two conventions? What do you think is the most sort of compelling – what are the most compelling things that you've been observing?
So for elections, it's not really convention-related, but I like it because it's coming up really, really close, really soon. It's the Missouri gubernatorial race. You have Democratic Governor Jay Nixon, who's termed out, and this Tuesday we have a four-way Republican primary to face – the Democratic Attorney General Chris Coster, and Missouri unfortunately has no campaign spending limit, no campaign limits whatsoever. So for donors, so
damn,
a millionaire could just, I mean, yeah, a millionaire could just donate a few million dollars to a candidate, and there's nothing stopping them. Like, they don't need to set up a super PAC or anything. They just dump a few million into that to someone's war chest, and that's happened for pretty much all the four Republican candidates. There's one, Eric Greitens. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's been on TV a lot. He was a Bush White House fellow. The polling has generally shown him with a small lead, but not a huge one, and some polls do show him trailing. But he's, interestingly, the candidate Democrats really don't seem to like. The Democratic Gubernatorial Governors Association recently just launched an ad campaign in the last days of the primary against him. And you don't do that unless you want to try to poison him with primary voters. And you have John Brunner, the only guy who doesn't have a really rich ally, because he's really rich himself, so he is his own rich ally. He's this kind of boring business guy. He actually, in the Missouri Senate race where Todd Akin ended up getting the nomination, Todd Akin beat him. So that's something he definitely wants to erase from his obituary. And you have – they seem to be the main candidates. They seem to be really going back and forth on TV against one another. You have two other ones, Katherine Hanaway. She was former U.S. attorney, former Speaker of the House. She she has this really rich guy, rich Missouri donor, who's financing her. And then we have a fourth, Peter Kinder. He ran for governor in 2012, but had to drop out a year early because he had a sex scandal, a pretty weird one, where someone who worked at a, I think it was a no pants club, called memorably called the Horny Toad. She said like he was harassing her or something. It was a really weird scandal, but it derailed his political ambitions for a little bit. But he did win re-election as lieutenant governor, and now he's trying again. He has the least amount of money. Polls generally show him not doing too well, but not impossible for him to win. And of the four,
well, in a four-way primary, I mean, it's just a few votes probably, especially
exactly.
in August. I mean,
exactly. And he's the only candidate who doesn't come from the St. Louis area, so if he can run up the score everywhere else, then he has a good shot. So it's a really competitive primary. We're going to be watching it on Tuesday, and that's one of the big ones we're watching. And the Democratic nominee is almost certainly going to be the Attorney General, Chris Coster. He's really well-financed, but Jay Nixon has kind of left a mixed legacy, especially with Ferguson. So we'll just have to see what happens.
Well, I'll be watching that on Tuesday, too. Now that all the conventions are over, you got to get your political Jones out somewhere.
Exactly.
And what was your favorite moment of the convention?
My favorite moment? There were so many good ones. I think Biden's speech, but that might just be because I love Joe Biden so much.
We all love Joe, except I watched Confirmation today, the HBO movie about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas situation. And Joe Biden did not come out of that looking very good, I must say.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. I should.
It's very good. It's very good. Very well done. I remember watching that, so I found it to be very, very well done. Anyway, that's our off subject. Back to David.
Yes. Well, Jeff, it's getting close to football season, and you're thinking, how in the world does this affect politics? Well, Donald Trump, man, he figured Hillary Clinton out. She is so powerful. She can get the debate commission to, even before she was the nominee and Trump was the nominee, she figured how to get all this thing figured out where two of the NFL games would be conflicting with two of the debates. Of course, one of those is a Falcons-Saints game, and I'm torn, of course, and I know you have Louisiana ties, because, of course, when the Falcons and Saints play and it's not a primetime game, the Falcons do great. When they put them on with big crowds watching, the Saints always show up. That's not only against the Falcons, that's everybody. So now I'm thinking, well, maybe we do need to go up against that debate so no one will be watching. But getting back to the bigger issue for everybody, what in the world is Donald Trump's end game here, criticizing – the Democratic campaign, the debate commission, possibly the NFL, even though he lied about the NFL sending him a letter.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
I mean, I'm not sure he actually does have an end game. So many of his little rants just don't seem to be going anywhere or planned at all. He might genuinely think that this was done to screw him somehow, even though this is not at all atypical, and the debate commission's bipartisan. It's not... The idea that this was done in some way to hurt Republicans is just insane. And it's not even – this has happened in previous years. There's been minimal complaints for a long time. But it's possible he's just trying to have an excuse to not debate Hillary. I mean, I'm not sure because I think he at least thinks he'll do really well in a debate because he's Donald Trump, so how could he not? But he did drop out of that debate right before the Iowa caucus, so if anyone's going to pull this, it's him. So he may just, for whatever reason, maybe pride, maybe stupidity, maybe just because he really doesn't think he'd actually do well against Hillary, he may be trying to find an excuse to not debate. Or maybe he's just trying to pick a fight and trying to get Hillary or the debate commission to call for moving it or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just an odd one that he's brought up. Well, one more before I see if Tim and Kath and everything else. And that would be Donald Trump and Russia. He has really talked about Russia a lot, even today, with saying that Russia would never – Putin would never invade Ukraine, and they'd have the email servers. What's the alliance, fascination, whatever you want to call it, between Donald Trump and seemingly Putin, not just Russia?
Well, Putin, I think, knows that Trump would be a much better president for him than Hillary. And so I can understand why Putin's doing this, would be doing stuff to help Trump. Trump, though, it's hard to say. He may have financial ties to Russia. We don't know because he won't release his tax returns. He may genuinely admire Putin. He may not really understand the situation whatsoever. Maybe a combination of all those. I'm not really sure. But Putin knows he's got a good thing going there with Trump, and I would not be surprised if Putin does some more things to try to rig the election for him or tilt things to help Trump.
Yes. Well, I'll go ahead and see if Tim and Catherine have anything else. Tim?
Oh, yes. I always have something else. You know me. Jeff, one group that we have been hearing about a whole lot this year, and this group is given credit for keeping this race basically almost tied at this point in some polls, and that is what voters, especially men without a college degree. Are we going to see a pitch battle all through the fall in just a little handful of states, basically targeting those voters because groups like Hispanics and African Americans, seem to be off the table? Is that going to be the whole focus?
I don't know if it'll be the whole focus, but I think it will be a focus. And if Trump doesn't have very many groups where he can do much better than Romney did, so that's one of them. So I think Hillary knows that, and picking Tim Kaine might have been an attempt to mitigate some of that. And we did see in the final two nights of the convention more of a focus on those types of voters. So I think we'll see some of it, but Hillary will also be will be targeting women, targeting better, well-educated voters, higher income voters in the suburbs. So there's going to be a lot of different focuses. Trump, who knows? I mean, he might not have the resources or the focus to target more than one group, or at least positively target more than one group. But Hillary, I think she'll go after a lot of different demographics, and that'll be one of them.
Mm-hmm. Dan, do you mind if I piggyback on to your question? I actually have a question for all three of y'all this one. Much has been made of it, I think rightfully so, about white voters without a college degree being much more likely to vote for Trump than Hillary Clinton. And one thing I've noticed when these kind of stories get out there about trends that have even nothing to do with politics, that a lot of times people that may fit into that group begin to say, well, I'd like to have a college degree. I just, hadn't been able to get it, or things didn't go right for me, but I want my kids to get it. And so they will then begin to change their behavior to kind of adapt towards the more educated citizenry. Do you think that if this story gets enough play, and Tim and Catherine, you jump in here too, if this story gets enough play that some of those voters, not all, but some might start saying, I want to kind of be like the more educated crowd, and his numbers will begin to slip just due to not peer pressure, but, normification, if you will. What do y'all think?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought of it. I do that could happen, but at the same time, part of Trump's appeal is you people got screwed. You people got some screwed by the economy. The economy's getting better for people, but not for you. So that's Trump's pitch. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But if it does, if he's going to keep things at all close, it's probably because it's resonating with those types of voters.
Yeah. Catherine, Tim, any thoughts on that theory?
Well, I have a thought on that. I think one of the things that the Republicans have been good at for decades is this aspirational messages, even though they're hollow in the end, but they use them to attract voters. And I would love if the Democrats could use some of that aspirational thinking and aspirational messaging to attract those very voters, because I think they do have a better chance of their children going to college, of them doing some further education under a Hillary Clinton presidency than under a Trump presidency. But that's a complicated message to get across, and we're all, 140 characters or less anymore. So, but I would love to see us use a more aspirational message, and I think we did that somewhat in the convention, which I think made it one of the things that made it so interesting and compelling to watch. So I would like to see that. I just don't know how successful it could be in the short attention span that we all have.
And Tim, this worked out well. You can respond to the question and then move it on to your next question.
Or I can just move it on to my next question, which is what I'm going to do. My chief fear about this election, Jeff, is this. Barack Obama could excite his base and get them to the polls. GW could do that. Bill Clinton could do that. Reagan, those guys could excite their voters and get them out there. I'm worried about turnout. Can Hillary Clinton excite the voters enough that she needs to get out there and vote? Because she's not the most exciting person in the world when compared to some of those other folks. And she has high negatives. We can't deny that. So will turnout be her chief problem on election day?
It could be a problem, but she does have Trump to help motivate her people to show up. I mean, fear could be a powerful motivator. And we'll have to see how her being potentially the first female president can play into that. That could be very exciting, but it's something she's mentioned. This time it hasn't really, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's emerged as like one of the big dominant themes the same way Obama being the first black president did 8 years ago. Maybe that's because Trump's overshadowing it. Maybe it's just because
Or maybe
everyone
it's because
knows
you're
Hillary.
A man.
Yeah, that could be. I might not be the right person to ask about this. And she did. They did mention the speeches, so.
Well, jumping in on that question then, and you look at the polling a lot deeper than I do, so I wanted to ask this. Is there a larger gender bias this year because of the fact that our first major party female nominee is on the scene?
I think it is a bit larger than usual from what I've seen. And a part of that may end up being, though, that men vote more Republican than usual. Maybe just part of it is a reaction to Hillary. Maybe part of it is Trump just doing better among white working class voters. So someone, I don't remember who, they did make the good case that Democrats often treat the gender gap as just favorable, saying, well, we're doing really well among women. So that's that.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's good on its own. But if there's some more bigger reaction among men in the wrong direction, then that is not what we want. So we'll just have to see. I mean, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, really. Okay, Catherine, go ahead.
I have a little bit of a different angle on that. Just, excuse me. I work with an office full of women that many of them have children, and I talk to a lot of people, many of whom have children. And I think that parents, especially parents of daughters, are really excited about this, and their daughters are really excited about the first potential woman president. So I think there may be some white middle-class working-class fathers that will vote for Hillary Clinton because they see in that historic moment an opportunity for their daughters. And I think that the campaign is using that angle in some of their advertising and in some of the messages we heard at the convention. So I think we need to see you know, we need to see some more polling on that before we jump to conclusions that white working class, you know, the white working class who maybe sometimes vote Democratic, sometimes vote Republican, may, especially if they have children, if they're parents, may look at this and think, yeah, I think the world for my children will be better if we have a Hillary Clinton presidency.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that could be a good motivator.
We can be helpful about that anyway.
Yes. Well,
go ahead, David.
One more question. Catherine, I'm sorry. I was going to see if you have one, Catherine. Jeff, one more question. It's about battleground states. We had a poll. You mentioned Missouri's governor's race. The St. Louis Dispatch commissioned poll through Mason-Dixon showed the Missouri race there for the presidency a total battleground. WSB had a landmark communications do one here in Georgia, showed Georgia's a total battleground state. I'm waiting for the Arizona poll to kind of fit in because those three states kind of get put together. What can we extrapolate, supposing these are good polls, if Georgia and Missouri are already battleground states and we kind of have a gut feeling that Arizona won't be any worse, possibly better? What can we extrapolate about the rest of the country?
I mean, if we operate under the assumption that those are battleground states, then the rest of the country is looking really good. I mean, Republicans these days, if they can't win without Missouri and Georgia, forget one or the other, forget both. If they're losing one, it probably means they've lost everything. At the same time, though, Hillary's campaign really hasn't begun targeting those states really yet. They've talked about it. At the convention, Robbie Mook, her campaign manager, said that about Georgia. Yeah, it's moving in our direction, but we're not sure when we're going to go into it. It might be in October. It might be in 2020. It might be in 2032, something like that. So I think I think Democrats want to target Georgia. They're just not sure if it's a good investment right now. And part of that with both Georgia and Missouri is if we're winning those states, it means we probably won already. So they're not going to be states that put Hillary over the top. They're nice bonuses. So they're going to have to decide whether that's true and what the best use of resources is and whether winnable at all. And Missouri is hard to put that one down. I mean, Hillary hasn't been airing there yet. And while the Mason-Dixon poll did show it at battleground, two other recent polls showed Trump winning by 10 points. And Missouri in recent years has really not been great for Democrats. In 2008, Obama almost won it, but after targeting it really heavily, 2012, he decided not to target it at all. Romney won it by about 9-10 points. So if Hillary's targeting it, it probably means she sees some good numbers, but so far she isn't. So I'm not sure if either of those states is going to be in play in November. I think if either of them are, it's more likely to be Georgia, but we'll see.
And honestly, I think the math ought to be, in addition to polling the presidential race, you poll the Senate races in each of those states, and if Johnny Isaacs and John McCain or the lady that could beat him in a primary or Roy Blunt are weak, then you put your money in that race more so than put the presidential to help that race more so than looking at which one's closer because you need the Senate seat. So that's kind of the second calculation I would look at if I was looking at those states.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Hillary's going to do that because she just she focuses on her own race, and it is still a lot of money to target a state. You know, you're not going to win even if there are some good benefits to it. I know not the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, they are targeting Arizona already. That's become a big battleground. Georgia, not so much.
Isaac no surprise there.
And the Democratic candidate does have money, so he can kind of carry his own weight. Missouri's kind of in the middle. Democrats have taken an interest in it. Jason Kander, the Democratic nominee, Democrats are helping him fundraise, but there haven't been very many ads there yet. Republican groups have aired some ads to help Roy Blunt, but so far Democratic groups haven't done the same thing. So that one's kind of hard to figure out. The polls do look good from what we've seen, but there haven't been that many polls, and We'll just have to see on that one. But Arizona definitely, I think, will be a battleground until November. So anything we can do there.
My advice, if you look at, you know, seeing her as somebody that wants to get things done, and I think Bill Clinton's story was a true story. She does want to get things done. She needs to have as many Democrats in the Senate and the Congress as she can because, you know, President Obama in the first 2 years of his term got Obamacare passed. Right now, in his last 2 years, he couldn't get the Republicans to purchase him a box of Band-Aids. So therefore, you've got to, you know, have some people to, you know, help pass your agenda. So I think somebody in the party is going to have to in particular look at winning the Senate and doing the best they can in the House. Of course, a tougher hill to climb. Well, Jeff, we sure do thank you for being on the Kudzu Vine tonight.
Well, thank you for having me again. It was great.
Yeah. Well,
and thanks a lot.
That's the end of the show tonight. Yeah, so this is also good night for us.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong and united America.